Good evening. My name is Perry Hoffman, and I want to welcome you to our second call-in series. We had 10 calls in the fall, and we now have 10 calls coming up for the winter series. So we're delighted to have many of you back and some new folks who've joined us as well. These calls are every Sunday night from 8 to 9. They are thanks to the generous donation of time to our top leading BPD experts. So we're very appreciative that our experts give of their time to not only present the presentations and their wonderful talks, but also to then come on the call for us for an hour. Anybody who has not received the handouts, please email me at neabpd@aol.com, and I will send you the handouts. And also, if you have any questions, please also email at neabpd@aol.com, and we will try to have some time for questions. I also want to give a big thanks to the Gunderson residents at McLean Hospital who are supporting this call-in series. It's the first time that an institution has supported so publicly the work that we're doing in this way. So we're very grateful to McLean and to the Gunderson residents for doing this. We have some other institutions that are supporting some of our other efforts. So that's a very exciting new initiative that's come aboard for NEA. It's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Brian Palmer, who I consider not only a colleague but a dear friend who I've known for several years and really, really do appreciate Brian's time. Brian, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you introduce yourself so people will get to know you personally from your perspective. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks, Perry, and it's nice to be with you and everyone this evening. You're so generous to acknowledge people joining the call that donate their time, but it occurs to me, Perry, that you spend week after week doing this work without any kind of compensation out of the goodness of your heart to advance this important work. So very nice to be here, and thank you for including me. It's terrific. The origin of this talk came in discussions that I've been having with Perry and a project that we've developed with NEABPD along with, when I was working at McLean Hospital, Dr. John Gunderson and Dr. Lois Choi Kane, who, speaking of the Gunderson residents, is the medical and program director at the Gunderson residents at McLean Hospital. And the four of us worked to develop a six-module curriculum for professionals who could then receive continuing medical education or continuing education credits in their discipline for pursuing these modules. So the idea is that people can work through these online, interactive, web-based modules and learn really the basics of what it is to take care of somebody with BPD, what the evidence shows, and then it has interactive quizzes and ways to assess learning that are built into that. And so we're in the final stages of just getting the continuing education credits approved either through McLean Hospital or Harvard Medical School, and that should be up and going at least within the next couple of months, I hope, if not sooner. So that's an exciting project. So for tonight, in giving sort of an overview of BPD and this work, I've pulled, I think, all of these slides, or nearly all of these slides, from that project. It's not the whole project. The curriculum itself takes at least 3 hours to work through, and since we're trying to compress this to about 45 minutes, I've just pulled the highlights from each section, but I hope it will give a nice overview of what we would consider kind of the basics that anyone working with people who have BPD and their families should know. And I know we have a mixed audience of professionals, families, consumers, and hopefully I'll be able to speak to something in the middle of that group. And Perry will forward me emails along the way if I'm not doing that adequately. So for the slides, I will do my best to let you know when I'm moving on to the next slide. And this is now slide two, diagnosis, epidemiology, and biology. So for each of these, we'll go through some of the key points in the area. So to begin, let's talk about the criteria. And for the criteria here, I've grouped them into the four basic phenotypes that we consider important to understand about borderline. The first is that it's an interpersonal hypersensitivity, so that the symptoms of borderline do not simply just crop up. They crop up in interpersonal relationships and in interpersonal situations, which is key to understanding the illness, and I'll go into that in a little bit more detail along with some of the details about treatment principles that are important from that perspective. But this phenotype includes the abandonment fears, unstable relationships, including moving from extremes from ideal to devalued, and then chronic feelings of emptiness. The second area is the affective or emotional dysregulation. This includes the two criteria that are intensely affective, including the affective instability, which we often get some confusion with bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder. In borderline, moods can certainly go from high to low, though they generally don't have a lot of highs. We don't see elations with borderline mood disorders. We also see the mood symptoms lasting hours to perhaps days, but rarely meeting the two-week criteria necessary for, say, a major depressive episode, although depression is common with BPD as well. Inappropriate intense anger is the other emotional. The third area is behavioral, and this is the area that typically brings people to treatment primarily, and in some treatments, it's the highest target for behavioral intervention. This includes recurrent suicidality, threats, self-harm, and then impulsivity in a couple of areas, including sex, driving, binging, and finally a disturbed sense of self. This includes unstable or distorted self-image, and under periods of extreme stress, people can experience quasi-psychotic symptoms, paranoia, depersonalization, a sensation that a person is not in her or his own body. So it's to make the diagnosis requires five of these nine criteria, and I think most people on the call are probably familiar with it, but thinking about it in terms of these four areas of interpersonal, affective, emotional, and self. And then with that, we can start to think about the interpersonal context for symptoms. So this is Dr. Gunderson's work, that if a person, a patient, feels cared about or held, they can appear depressed, waif-like. If the person feels threatened, the result is anger with self-injury. And perhaps concerningly, most concerningly, if a person feels alone, she or he can feel desperate, impulsive, disconnected. And the clinical pearl here is that the real risk of suicide in borderline is when a person with borderline concludes that she cannot be loved, and that ultimate sense of aloneness really can be overwhelming and unbearable. But thinking for clinicians to think about the relational aspect of BPD. So when I teach residents, I didn't actually say where I am. I'm currently at Mayo Clinic, and I do a lot of education work here at Mayo. And when I teach residents, I will often have them come from the ER and say, well, she didn't seem borderline. And I think by which the resident meant she didn't seem angry. But that may be that the holding environment of the ED really changed the presentation, and it's understanding the context in which symptoms occur that is really the important piece. So on the next slide, myths about BPD. The first of these is that it's unwise to share the diagnosis. I'll go into that a little bit in a minute. The second myth is that BPD cannot be diagnosed in an acute setting, and that actually really is a myth that has now been studied. In fact, we diagnose most all of our psychiatric conditions in acute settings. Number three, it's a myth that you can treat comorbid Axis I disorders effectively without treating BPD. And I think this is an important pearl, that the depression certainly is the most well-studied comorbid Axis I disorder, meaning a co-occurring disorder with borderline. And depression is seen to be treatment resistant, I'm going to go into this in a little bit more detail later on, until the BPD improves. And considering BPD the primary diagnosis is clinically indicated, that's, I will modify that slightly with co-occurring substance use disorders, which should also be treated as primary. The fourth myth is that borderline patients try to defeat their therapists. Sometimes has felt that way. In my own experience, that is absolutely a myth. This is not the goal. Most people with borderline are quite miserable with their lives and are looking for help and looking to feel better and need to learn how to do that. The next myth is that patients with borderline do not improve. In fact, I'll show you some data about that in a minute. And the last myth actually is that I have to know dialectical behavioral therapy to treat borderline. It's true that DBT is a terrific treatment, and I have been intensively trained, and I have worked in a DBT residential program and led outpatient DBT groups and individual therapies with DBT, and I like the treatment a lot, but it certainly is not the only way to treat borderline, and I think understanding some principles that cross different treatments is also important. On the next slide, thinking about making the diagnosis, taking history. So to tie this together, are the symptoms triggered by interpersonal stress, i.e. a breakup? Is the depression treatment resistant? Does the patient self-harm, and what is the function of the self-harm? Are the relationships unstable? And so I think for the clinicians on the call, thinking about how do I start to recognize borderline in people I'm working with, these are, I think, key clinical questions to consider. On the next slide, this is unpublished data from a fairly small study at McLean, but they basically just measured what happens when we tell people they have borderline. And they looked at outcomes in terms of a person's own sense of shame, likability, hope, and then overall appraisal. And it turns out that people don't feel any more or less shame when they're given the diagnosis. They don't feel more or less likable. But what they do feel is more hopeful. And that has been absolutely true in my clinical experience, that it's so confusing to have emotions that are intense, the relationships that are chaotic, to know that there's a problem, and to be constantly told either it's your own fault or stop it or some sort of rejection of the experience that really worsens the problem. And so to say, okay, we know what this is. It is something that can be defined, diagnosed, can actually get quite a bit better, and will take work to get better, I think is very hope-engendering to patients. I had a patient just this week that I made the diagnosis for the first time, and she was relieved, I think, that someone was saying, yes, I understand what is happening here. We have a way of thinking about this, and I could give her treatment recommendations that made very good sense to her. And that was, I think, in contrast to several other evaluations she had had where she left feeling just demoralized, not understanding herself or not feeling understood in the interaction. Next, basic epidemiology. This is slide 8, in case I have forgotten to let people know that we're moving on a slide. The basic epidemiology, prevalence, this is a highly prevalent disorder in clinical samples. In fact, 20% of both outpatient and inpatient samples are estimated to have borderline. That's certainly true in my clinical experience. I used to work in outpatient programs, and now I'm on an inpatient unit, and I would say it's actually higher than 20% on our inpatient units. So common, and it's overrepresented in primary care settings as well. In the general population, we quote a pretty wide range for the epidemiology, 1.2 to 5.9%. The 5.9% is actually the most reliable of the numbers. It comes from a 40,000-person household survey that was conducted with a very rigorous methodology and thoughtful interviews. So it actually is the most likely the most accurate number. The fact that it's higher than what we've seen before makes most of us want to at least quote that there's a range, but I think more and more we're thinking that it's a highly prevalent disorder in the general population. In terms of gender, about 75% of people in clinical samples are female, though in this community study, it's closer to 50-50 male to female. There are different explanations for this, and I don't, I have theories about it. I don't think there's good data to support any particular theory, but that it's likely true that men are more likely to end up in either substance use disorder treatment or in legal system problems than women, and that it's more culturally acceptable for women to be in mental health care treatment for these problems. But I'm not, that may not fully explain the situation. I think we need to learn more about that. So next slide is about making the diagnosis. And the first two facts come from Zimmerman's work at Brown, and the Brown, terrific hospital, and in an outpatient sample there, they reviewed who has borderline, who was then told they have borderline, and found that in their sample, only two of the 61 patients with borderline were actually given the diagnosis. And then the next slide, the next bullet point on this slide, 40% of patients who do have borderline and do not have bipolar. Obviously, some patients with borderline also do have bipolar disorder, but we're talking about patients who do have borderline and do not have bipolar disorder have been inaccurately given the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And I've seen this done, and I have never quite understood why clinicians, I think they want to protect patients from their own countertransference or their own dislike of patients with borderline by diagnosing them inaccurately with bipolar disorder, but it's a real travesty to do so. The bipolar disorder outcomes are actually worse than borderline, and the treatment would be quite different and should be different. So that's a current state of our field and is unfortunate. The third was an interesting study that came out last January in the American Journal of Psychiatry and showed that when someone has a major depressive episode, that doesn't change the accuracy of diagnosing borderline, which is, I think that was welcome news to me. Even when I was in residency, which was fairly recently, we were taught that we shouldn't really diagnose borderline in the midst of a depressive episode because it was difficult to tell what was borderline and what was the depressive episode, but that has now been studied and answered. On to, next slide, heritability and familiality. In the big twin studies, genes accounted for, and I have to say this very precisely, 69% of the variance in diagnostic concordance, meaning of two twins, or the concordance rate is how frequently they both have, either do have BPD or don't have BPD. When those vary, that's what we say is the genes account for the variance, so 69% of the variance in diagnostic concordance is accounted for by genes. And then across the nine family studies that have been done, this is high. 12.6% of first-degree relatives of someone with BPD also have BPD, which was in these studies four times higher than the non-borderline probands. So I think both of these facts put together the picture that this is a very heritable disorder. In fact, on the next slide, we can see it grouped under heritability, and these are ballpark estimates that are, frankly, they're difficult to establish how genetic any given psychiatric illness is, but looking at these ballpark estimates, it seems that schizophrenia and bipolar, which are well known to be very genetic illnesses, as well as ADHD, borderline is right up there, far ahead of major depressive disorder, panic disorder, PTSD, other common psychiatric illnesses. So the contribution of genetics to borderline, I think is safe to say, is quite high. And we appropriately share that with families. In the course, what I have not included for tonight's talk are some of the neuroimaging data, and I'll just say briefly that in terms of the biology, what we are starting to understand, I think, I'll just give the broad brush, is that people with borderline have a more active limbic system, or the kind of emotional response part of the brain, in response to the same stimulus gets more active. And then unfortunately, just at the time people need the thinking part of the brain, the cortex, to really kick in and sort out the emotions, that for reasons that I think I'm not sure we totally understand yet, does not get as activated. And so it's a double whammy condition, and this is where I think the biology and the genetics really must play a large role, where people have more activation of the emotional response within their brain to the same stimulus, and then less cortical activation, less ability to sort through, think through, figure out what's going on with their emotions, which is, you know, the worst of both worlds. And I think that combination is what we see neurobiologically. On to slide 12. This is the section we're going to talk about. This would be the second module of the course. We talk about course and outcome, and we begin with suicidality and self-harm. And noting that suicide and self-harm and borderline are unfortunately common and certainly dangerous, 65 to 70% of people with borderline make at least one suicide attempt in their lives, which is, actually I'm surprised it's as low as that in my clinical experience. It's at least that. And that 10% of patients with borderline do eventually complete suicide. And that's a really terrible outcome for all of us, and I think engenders a lot of worries in both family members and professionals. Self-injury is seen in about 75% of patients. And why do people self-injure? And that's a complicated question, and we could go into a lot of detail on it. The one study I like that's been done, this was among a sample of inpatients. People were asked, you know, to what extent does this function accurately represent what you got out of the self-injury? And these numbers don't all add up to 100%, so somebody could have multiple functions of the self-injury. But people are looking to feel concrete pain, to inflict self-punishment, to reduce anxiety and despair, to gain a sense of control, sometimes to express anger, to feel something when numb, to seek help from others, or to keep away bad memories. And I think those functions are obviously different. They cross a spectrum, and there's no simple answer that one size fits all in terms of the function of self-injury. But I think it's important for clinicians, family members, consumers, all of us, to recognize that self-injury has a function. It works. It's doing something useful, and is obviously has its problems, and it's something we take seriously, but it's coming from somewhere that has an adaptive response, at least in this study. The next slide is about the longitudinal course of borderline, and this is a very busy slide, but it's my favorite because it combines the two big studies of borderline's course. The first is going to be, I'm going to talk about them both, and I'll go through all these dots so everybody will understand. But in the blue, we have the MSAD, the McLean Study of Adult Development, and this is Dr. Mary Zanarini's research lab at McLean, and they followed 362 inpatients for, I guess now, 16 years, which is frankly incredible, the amount of follow-up and the richness of the data that Dr. Zanarini and her team have produced. And what they found was initially shocking. So if you look at the blue line, this is years of follow-up. So they went from the hospital admission, was year zero. The 2 years after diagnosis, 34.5% of their sample no longer met the criteria for borderline. They'd achieved remission. And this went on up to 80%, 82% by year 10. So that what they were finding, which is, I think, for this group is probably old news, but for the profession in general was, and still is, somewhat surprising that people with borderline really get quite a bit better. Of course, there's a sampling bias for clinicians because we only see the people who don't get better, who keep coming back into the hospital, et cetera. So there's an artificial nihilism that gets created in professionals. But if you just look at a sample of people with borderline, actually quite a few get quite a bit better. The other big study, which shows the exact same thing, is the Collaborative Longitudinal Personality Disorder Study. And this is a multi-center study headed up by John Gunderson. Both of these were funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health. And Dr. Gunderson's work showed that at the beginning, the folks in that study met an average of 6.7 out of those 9 criteria that I started with. And by the end of year 2, they met an average of 3.8 of the 9 criteria, which is falling below the threshold of 5 needed to make the diagnosis. And that by the end of year 10, they did still meet criteria, 1.7 on average, about 2 of the 9 criteria people still had, but that the again, this is falling into the category of remission, so that most people within that 10-year period get quite a bit better. Now, there's some caveats on the next slide. In that second study, the CLIP study, only about one-third had full-time employment at 10 years, obviously concerning. And borderline was seen there to have a negative effect on major depressive disorder, and it was treatment-resistant until the borderline remitted. But the inverse of that was not true. So depression really had a modest effect on the course of borderline. So what they show is that as people have fewer symptoms, they tend to function better. And that was seen to be significant. What we think is probably also true is that as people function better, they have fewer symptoms, although that in the CLIP study did not quite reach the level of statistical significance. I wish it had so that I could quote it as scientific fact, but I think this idea that functioning in life is related to symptoms, we know for sure that people function better in life when they have fewer symptoms, but I believe it's probably also true that as people function better, that continues to lessen the symptoms. And certainly in my clinical experience, as people are able to negotiate their way through a return to work or a volunteer job and begin to have relationships that matter to them, their symptoms also improve and they learn to manage. So some thoughts about improvement. This is a complicated slide, and I'm not going to it requires about 5 minutes to talking very precisely to get through it, but this was that data from the 40,000 household survey that looked at borderline. And what they were looking at is for people who had depression that stuck around. So they were looking for the number of people who had depression initially. I guess I may go through most of this. Who had depression initially was 24, 22. And they were able to re-interview a couple thousand of those at 3 years. So 2,000 people with depression interviewed at the beginning and then interviewed 3 years later. Of that 2,000, about 15% had continuous depression through that 3 years, and 7.3% had a recurrence of their depression after remission. So most people with depression get better, and the depression frequently comes back, but in this study, the depression got better in a couple thousand people, except for 15% who had persistent depression through that whole time and 7.3% who had a recurrence. And what they did was they controlled for all the possible causes of this, all axis 1 and 2 disorders, age of onset, number of prior depressive episodes, family history treatment, everything. And borderline remained the most robust predictor of major depressive disorder persistence, meaning that 15% who stayed depressed, most of those was accounted for by borderline. So on the last bullet point, 57% of cases would not have persisted, stayed depressed, in that follow-up period in the absence of BPD. So I think in terms of this idea that treatment-resistant depression is frequently caused by borderline personality disorder, I think that's an important contribution and people who are mood disorder researchers, I think, are beginning to see that the overlap between mood disorders and personality disorders is worth continuing to pursue. So, clinical pearls from this second section. Most patients with PPD achieve remission. Good news. Impulsive symptoms, at least in the McLean study of adult development, tend to decline more rapidly than the affective symptoms. Third, BPD negatively affects the course of major depressive disorder. Fourth, work and social functional impairment persists even after symptoms improve, but improving functioning can predict improvement in symptoms and vice versa. So. Next, principles of treatment. Now, of course, this is going to be impossible in a 45 to 50 minute, I probably run closer to 55 minutes at the rate I'm going, call to cover all of treatment. And so in the course, we spend two modules on this, and I've compressed it for tonight's version into one, and I am going to breeze through much of that for tonight. But the treatment principles we look at in two ways. One is how a treatment is structured, and I have a couple of slides on that. And then second is what happens in a treatment. So the first, we're on to slide 21, levels of care, is considering where somebody is appropriate for treatment. So a hospital is that, doesn't say it on the slide, but a hospital is that first bar, and that reflects that most people end up hospitalized at some point, and that's how they come to clinical attention. But in the hospital, even though a lot of hospitals now are doing some very quick immersion in DBT skills and providing rapid stabilization, that's not where people really learn to manage their emotions and live in the world. That's as an outpatient. But people who are not able to manage outpatient therapy need a higher level of care. And so this slide helps look at levels of care, and I won't go into any more details on that tonight. The next slide is a complicated slide. This is from Dr. Lois Choi Kane, and I find this a very helpful clinical slide to consider. And basically in this slide, I'm going to go through it in detail. I'll probably take a couple of minutes to talk about it. We consider several things, but basically the point is these are people with borderline personality disorder. Of course there are going to be problems in the relationship of a treatment. A treatment relationship is a relationship, and this is by definition a disorder of relationships. So given that, rather than be surprised by the problems that come, we should be expecting that and learn to see that both as part of the illness and to have treatment that responds to that. So, for example, here are three. The first dilemma and disruption on the left-hand side is the control struggle and boundary problems that can come with BPD. Most people on the call can relate to that. So, how do we fix that, or how do we address that in treatment? We have clear goals, clear expectations, and clear limits. So here's the way this works, and we just agree to it up front what it's going to be. Second, symptomatic bids to test availability and responsiveness of treaters. So, for example, it's not uncommon to receive a call that someone is in distress and has cut herself as a way of showing the distress, but that's about communicating a lot of distress. So we expect that's going to happen. How do we respond to it? In two ways. One is to take a supportive but non-reinforcing stance. So I would make an error if every time my patient got distressed, I got really, really supportive and gave extra sessions and saw lots of extra times and that kind of stuff, because what I would be saying is the way to connect, the way to share your distress is through increasing your symptoms. And we have certainly, in mental health, seen that happen lots. The second simultaneous or complementary approach is we want to take a non-reactive but careful attention to the provocative behavior. So I could also err on the side of saying, you know, if you do that again, we can't work together. Well, but I know that's the illness, and that's what I'm here to treat. And so taking that would be a reactive response to a provocation. We don't want that, but we want a thoughtful, methodical, okay, well, now how should we respond? So, you know, sharing the dilemma together about, okay, well, Now, on the one hand, if I get more supportive, then that would basically say to you, every time you are in trouble, all you need to do is use the behavior. That would not help you. That would make you worse. But I, on the other hand, don't want to ignore your distress, and we need a way to manage that together. So what do you propose? And then we share the dilemma. And I think that style is, we go into this in a lot more detail in the course, but that basic style of trying to share in the process of working through this together is important. The last one is this notion of splitting, which is a less used term this day, but the, in a team, some members end up being on the good side, other members end up being on the bad side, and different people have different information. It can be a challenge, and yet is necessary in working with patients to have a team. And so we expect that is going to be the case, rather than, I think, for 30 years our field seemed to be surprised every time this would happen. So let's just expect that that's going to happen, and then how do we as team members work to both assume the best in everyone, gently point out blind spots where people are not seeing. It's often hard when you're the one that's well-liked to see that you're on a positive side of a split, but it's very easy when you're the one that's on the negative side to see it more clearly. And so how do we just expect that that's going to be the case and work together in a team that way? So those are, again, these are some general broad brush considerations for this sort of treatment that we could obviously spend hours and going into depth on. There are now six empirically validated treatments for borderline, and I've listed them on your slide. And we'll go through a few of the basics, although I suspect that most people on this call probably have some good ideas about most of the basics of these. But they occur across a spectrum. This is the next slide that says a spectrum of approaches. On the one side is cognitive behavioral interventions, so learning interventions that change thinking or change behaviors primarily. They're not as focused on looking at, say, the relationship with the therapist. That would be a much more dynamic treatment, and that would be on the far right-hand side, the psychodynamic approach called transference-focused psychotherapy. The others occupy a middle ground, mentalization-based treatment, general psychiatric management, and schema-focused therapy. Next slide, DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. Again, we're certainly not going to be able to go into that in any detail this evening. It does by far have the highest number of research studies and is shown to be effective for the treatment of suicidal behaviors and substance abuse. It is very easy to learn, which is a very good thing. Unlike some of the dynamic approaches, DBT can be learned in a week-long or two-week-long intensive course and needs a lot of supervision and skill to do and a lot of practice to get good at, but it really can be learned. And it's prepackaged and can be used in a broad number of settings. So on the inpatient unit I work on, we have a number of nurses who have learned basic DBT skills. We have videos for patients that feature Marsha Linehan, and we use basic DBT skills to help people re-regulate in the hospital. So a reasonable intervention. That is not, what I just described, is not dialectical behavioral therapy. DBT has four parts. One is an individual DBT therapist that has a behavioral orientation and focuses on reduction of targeted behaviors or increasing of other targeted behaviors. Second component is that that therapist and the treatment team work together and they meet at least weekly for a consultation team where they're talking about their own work together so that there's consultation involved. The third is the accessibility of skills coaching for generalization. So when I was doing DBT and a patient would page me saying, hey, I'm really struggling. I know we talked about this, but I can't remember this skill, or here's what I've tried so far. What can I work on? That's where the therapy can really help people learn to apply what they're doing in the real world. By the way, the way this should work is that if a patient calls me after she's engaged in the behavior that we're trying to stop, say cutting, then I would not want to provide skills coaching at that point, because the problem has already probably been relieved by the cutting, and I would be reinforcing the behavior we're trying to extinguish. So that would be a DBT approach to that. And then the fourth is what most people think of with DBT, is the skills group, and that has four modules, and I've listed them on the next I didn't list them on the slides. I cut that slide out. Four modules that go through emotion regulation, distress tolerance, interpersonal effectiveness, and then the core skill is mindfulness. What am I feeling? What are my thoughts and feelings? How can I feel my feelings without reacting to them? And so the approach is about dialectics, working toward minimizing black and white thinking, seeing both and. Therapists take a validating stance that is balanced, an accepting stance that is balanced. So, of course, this makes sense. You know, no one acts randomly. Everyone's behavior makes sense. And we need to work to change certain behavior. So we do both of these simultaneously. Next slide. I'm not going to go into any detail on mentalization-based treatment other than to say it's another one. And the third one, general psychiatric management, by the way, found to be as effective as dialectical behavioral therapy, although it's only had one head-to-head study, basically uses the APA treatment guidelines and is sort of the style that I'm talking about here tonight, of knowing the general principles that work well with borderline patients and applying those. So it has weekly consultation, a helping relationship that is focused on what's happening here and now. It does use validation, empathy. It's very practical. So is this helping you meet your goals? And if not, why not? What's in the way and how do we work together? But basically, the stance is one of curiosity, of helping a patient get curious about his own experience and learn to describe his or her own experience. Sounds actually a lot like mindfulness, and I think it is a lot like mindfulness. So forming a narrative that makes sense of this is what is hard for me in this moment, and being able to understand what's happening rather than just act it out. And that's the basic orientation of the therapist in general psychiatric management, which I think is, again, that should cross all treatments and is the important piece of this. So the common features of effective therapy, next slide, they're specialized to address borderline. They're structured. They're coherent and stable, not reactive. They involve contracting. They involve a plan for what we will do if there is a crisis. The therapists themselves have supervision for managing their own responses. Therapists who work with borderline patients generally do best if they take an active stance. Therapists who sit back and wait for the patient to come to a new understanding generally are not as successful with this patient population. And the last one is the progress is monitored. Is this working? How do we know it's working? What are the goals for treatment? And keeping it grounded in the goals helps prevent some of the pitfalls that can come with these treatments. So that's a summary of basic treatment principles. The next section, psychopharmacology, I'm not going to go into very much detail, though I did provide more slides on this section than I than you might have expected, because it's in the slides where the action probably is. But the basics, I'm going to skip the dilemma, and I'm going to move to the goals of psychopharm. So this is slide 32. Pharmacotherapy often has an important adjunctive role, especially for affective instability, impulsivity, and psychotic-like symptoms. So meds help. In the studies, meds help, except for benzodiazepines, which generally make people worse. But meds help and can be used, but meds certainly do not fix borderline. And I think this is where this bipolar question comes in, and a wish that we could have such success with BPD, but that's just not the case. Therapy is the mainstay of treatment and should be. And we think of borderline as an engine that fuels, what's the next slide, mood symptoms, anxiety, substance abuse, impulsivity, eating disorder, etc. So the principles are to collaborate and determine goals and set accurate expectations. Like, what are we going to try to do with this? And then how do we know it's working? And to be methodical and collaborate. And the goal is to use psychopharm to help the patient fully engage in therapy. So I'm not going to go into the details of the specific agents, except to point out that on the benzodiazepine, Xanax is the one drug studied that has really shown to worsen symptoms and shows an increase in behavioral discontrol. And then my summary, my at-a-glance slide, this is slide 40, and that's the one that has the chart with the pluses. This is a summary of a meta-analysis by Ingenhoven. I think this is very consistent with what Dr. Ken Silk from the University of Michigan, who is a much more sophisticated psychopharmacologist than I am and has a much more sophisticated presentation on psychopharm than I'm including here. But this is a very similar take-home point to, I think, some of his summary of the literature, although his is modestly different than this. But basically, the Ingenhoven meta-analysis, which is my favorite of the big meta-analyses that have been done, looked at six areas where meds can help. And what they found was that the antipsychotics can help with anger, some. Not so good with depressed mood. That down arrow by the mood means depressed mood. Not so good with anxiety. Okay, with impulsivity. Good with the cognitive perceptual things, which we would expect for antipsychotics. The antidepressants in the middle group, it turns out, just don't do as well as we hoped they would. A lot of people with BPD are started on an SSRI, and that's fine. There's probably not a big downside to it, and I think that was everyone's thinking. But the data are more supportive of the mood stabilizers, probably being the first-line psychopharm. Lithium is less indicated, partially because it's potentially lethal in overdose, but also that it has less benefit unless someone has bipolar 1. But the anticonvulsant mood stabilizers really do seem to have some greater benefit for BPD, which, by the way, is what leads people to call this a bipolar spectrum illness as well, because mood stabilizers can help with bipolar spectrum illnesses. So there you go. So the last section, I'm skipping forward two slides, is about family involvement. And I know I'm speaking to a number of consumers, family members, and professionals, so I'm just going to hit some high points, and I know this series focuses on that. But for professionals, we want people to know that families struggle with reactions and responses that are very similar to those of professionals working with these patients. The decreasing reactivity is key, and the way to decrease reactivity is to decrease blame. By responding with curiosity, understand what's happening here, rather than judging it. I mean, these are key principles from DBT, from GPM, from any good therapy, that decreasing reactivity by decreasing blame can help. Family involvement requires structure. Principles are actually a little bit different than those of other psychiatric patients because of the relational element of this. And validation and a focus on effectiveness can make for real change in families. So the principles, I won't get into too much detail, so allow a little bit of time for questions. But first, and this is a summary of what we did at McLean with multiple family groups, which is available on the NEA-BPD website for download. And if you haven't used these or seen these yet, I think the Family Guidelines brochure is outstanding. Of all the stuff that's out there, if you want a short, basic text for families to use, I give this to family members several time a week basis in my practice when I'm orienting someone, a family of someone with BPD, to learn some basic principles. This is it. The long version is going to be the Family Connections course, which I have run in the past and is a much better, more in-depth, terrific way to go. But the basic principles are these. First, go slowly. Change is hard. And then a couple of important points that be cautious about you can do it reassurances. A lot of family members like to relieve their own anxiety by saying, oh, things like seem like they're getting better. But if you think about it, that doesn't make much sense. And I have the example here that experienced hospital staff don't tell borderline patients at discharge that they think they're going to do just great. What they say is, this is going to be hard. And that principle is important. Work in small steps and set realistic goals. Number two, in terms of the family involvement, engagement is important, people actually, and this is Perry Hoffman's research, do better when they're emotionally engaged with their family members. So families that sort of tune out or disengage, that's not helpful. Engagement is useful, but it needs to be modulated. So appreciation is normal, tone it down. Disagreement is normal, tone it down. But the pieces we're really trying to tone down are the blame and the judgment. And those are the pieces that escalate anger, shame, fear. And what we want to encourage is emotional engagement around non-blaming, non-judgmental topics. So describing your own experience is an emotional engagement that works quite well. Maintain family routines. Find time to talk about neutral topics. Useful. Next slide. This is one of my favorite quotes from Marshall Linehan, who just said, assuming the worst is destructive, and finding benign interpretations of people's behavior, having the basic orientation that people are all, we are all doing the best we can. Everyone on this call is doing the best we can, and we all need to learn how to do better. And that's a wonderful part of making life rich, and gets us out of the trap that everyone can get into with blame and judgment. Third, in terms of anger, pay attention and stay calm. So if somebody is angry, and this is important for the professionals and family members, if a person is angry and they're putting it into words, this is good. What we get concerned about is when people are angry and they're putting it into action. But if they're putting it into words and saying, I'm angry at you over this, usually there's some merit to the point, and if there's a way to acknowledge what part of it is legitimate, that really can be helpful. And I think in my own growth as a therapist working with patients with borderline, this has been very helpful, that if a patient is saying, you did not understand a thing I said last week, I can't even believe I came back, you know, if I can respond with, well, I'm glad you came back, but tell me more. What did I miss? And I'm acknowledging, oh, I can see I did miss that, if I did. That can be very, very helpful and helps the patient realize her own experience makes sense. And it's also just a very human thing to do and helps us all grow. So don't reject accusations and don't overpersonalize them. I mean, it is possible that you're not a terrible parent, even though it may also be true that you did that thing she said you did. It's okay. Next point is to address problems. Self-destructive acts do require attention. And then the next point, I think, is important. When solving a family member's problems, collaborate. Ask them what they can do. Ask what you can do to help and support. That's that same principle that I was talking about in working in therapy with borderline patients. Like, how can we collaborate about this to make a plan going forward? It is helpful for parents to stay consistent with their strategies, but if you have concerns about their treatment, especially if you're paying for it, let your family member know and let their treaters know. And then fifth, the last slide, in terms of limits, and this is certainly warrants a longer presentation than one slide here, and maybe in your series you'll have something on limits more. But limits are best when they're expressed as the limit of your own tolerance. Limits are for you. So that's I can't tolerate that. And be clear and simple. Waffling promotes problems. So this is my limit because I can't tolerate it. And that's actually very freeing. If you know in your heart you just can't tolerate whatever that is, that can be very freeing. Do not protect family members from the natural consequences of their actions. So if somebody's behavior gets them into trouble, it's their problem to solve. Family members can really do harm when they rush in every time there's a problem. Really, they should be rushing in when people are really making efforts to be independent and manage their emotions and work on that. That's when they should increase support. When people are struggling and not doing not using behaviors effectively, not engaging in treatment, etc., family members can undermine the need to get into treatment by solving the patient's problems for them. Limits are not coercive control tactics. These will backfire. So if you find yourself thinking, if I just hold this limit, then she will do X, Y, or Z, that's not a limit. That's coercion, and it usually just does not work very well. And then don't tolerate abusive behaviors. just walk away and come back later. So that's at least some summary. The brochure has more detail on that. In terms of professionals, we do encourage professionals to encourage parents to be involved, and I think that that's important, and certainly, you know, this group tonight is well aware of that importance. And the last slide is to sing the praises of Family Connections, which I just think is a tremendous resource, and many of you have been through it, but it's it really can be life-changing for a lot of families to learn some basic skills to manage their own emotional responses in the face of a disorder that has a lot of intense emotionality. So that ends my slides, and I think I have 5 minutes for questions.
Brian, thank you so much. I mean, you just always run through these things. You make everything a little clearer when there's really so much chaos going on around the disorder at times. Could you just say a minute of how this is going to fit into what psychiatrists and psychiatric residents are going to learn? In terms of what you've taken from the course, where does this all fit in? Is this like half of the course or a third of it or what?
Yeah, this is actually close to half of the course. It's a little light on some of the treatment specifics and going through the dilemmas that come up in a treatment. But other than that, it's actually a fairly good sampling of the course. So these are kind of the basic things that we think every psychiatrist, psychologist, social worker, trainee should be learning.
Can you also say what they are currently learning? Because I think we hear so often that the stigma is amongst the mental health professionals. So what actually are psychiatrists in training learning about borderline?
Yeah, it's variable by program. Lois Choicane and I presented a model curriculum at ADPERT, the training director meeting, last year, and had a lot of interest in it. In fact, you and I, Perry, along with John Gunderson, Dr. John Gunderson, Dr. John Oldham, and Dr. Ken Silk, and Jim Hall, who I don't know if he's on the call or not. But
yeah, Jim's
Hall,
on the call.
Good. The six of us did a two-day workshop for residents, psychiatric residents, and I was shocked, actually, that we had 75 people attend the first day looking to learn basics about borderline. And then the second day, which was at a different time in a different room, we had 100 people attend. And I think they went out and found their friends and brought them back. So there's really some genuine interest, I think, on the part of people going into the profession. I interview for residency, all the candidates who are coming through Mayo to consider doing their residency training here. And to a person, people want to learn. They think a psychiatrist should learn how to take care of difficult patients. And somehow across a training program that can come out the other side with a little more cynicism or a little more frustration. And I think what happens is people feel anxious and they don't feel like they have good skills. And then they don't get good supervision, and then they just want to distance themselves from a patient population. But if instead people can say, okay, well, here's a challenging person to work with, how do I learn to be effective? Really, that approach works a lot better, and I think it's clearly where the field is headed. This is 20% of our patient population, and there is so much energy, not just on the consumer side with NAMI and other groups really advocating borderline much more, but I think in the professional spectrum we're seeing a nice increase, at least in particularly a younger generation of up-and-coming people who want to learn what they're doing with borderline and realize, oh, you could actually learn how to take good care of these folks and they can get quite a bit better, and then it gets rewarding. So I think in some ways that's more anecdotal, but in other ways we're seeing from the data that there are more and more people that are putting their time and energy into learning about this stuff, and that our courses are filling up and people are expressing interest and institutions are putting together more resources for it. So I think it's a hopeful process.
Okay, terrific. Just one or two questions more, Brian. Your slide on BPD criteria is very helpful in drawing together the criteria that we find in DSM-4. With that in mind, can you recommend a one- or two-sentence summary of the pertinent aspects of BPD as it might be understood by a non-professional person?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's see what I can do, and I'll let you answer it too, Perry, if you want. The BPD is a disorder in which people, when they're in relationships, have intense emotions that can be difficult to manage, and that they manage frequently with behaviors that can cause a second set of problems on top of that, and that the treatment involves learning what that emotional experience is, how to manage it skillfully, and period.
Okay, I'm going to ask you another question along with that, Brian.
Yeah.
So often a spouse will come in and say that typically it's the wife, has BPD, and yet in every other aspect of her life, you don't see symptoms of the disorder. What would you respond to that sort of frame?
Right. So thinking interpersonally, that we do see, I mean, there are my patients with borderline, when they're at work, do extremely well and get along well with their colleagues. But as soon as they start any kind of a dating relationship, or with their families, or with people that get to know them well, they get much more symptomatic. So there may be a grain of truth in that person's observation that the relationship is chaotic. And if you find yourself diagnosing your spouse with something, there's probably a problem in the relationship. And seeing it as a problem in the relationship and as primary, especially if someone's not having symptoms outside the relationship, would be the way to go with that, I would think. Does that answer and make sense to you?
Okay, yes. No, absolutely. Appreciate that that response. We have a lot more questions, Brian. Maybe if I sent them on to you, you might have a chance to look them over. And, well, we'd always love to have you back. Maybe we can also post something on these questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, I want to thank you so much. I always enjoyed listening to your presentations. I want to remind people, well, first of all, that we have a Family Connections training in Los Angeles in February. These are for people who want to become Family Connections leaders. If you've gone through the course, either the Teleconnections or the Family Connections course, or have gone through NAMI's Family to Family course and want to become trained to be a Family Connections leader, please send an email to neabpd@aol.com. Also want to remind you that next week calls is at the same time. We have Michelle Galletta, who will be talking about aggressive behavior and borderline personality disorder. So thank you again to all of you for participating. And, Brian, again, thank you, as always, so much for doing a wonderful presentation. And I'm getting in emails saying thank you.
Oh, good.
So good night, everybody. We look forward to seeing you next week.